The primary presenter of the afternoon was Bernard Jacobson. Mr. Jacobson is a board member of the Theodore Presser Company, has worked as a contributing editor for Fanfare magazine, a music critic for the Chicago Daily News, a visiting professor of music at Roosevelt University in Chicago, music director of the Residenti Orchestra in The Hague, and was an artistic advisor to the North Netherlands Orchestra. Many of us here in Philadelphia know him as the program annotator and resident musicologist of the Philadelphia Orchestra during the tenure of Maestro Riccardo Muti. He has written books on Brahms and on conducting, and has written a book on recent Polish music entitled A Polish Renaissance. He has also of late been active as a narrator, most recently participating in a splendid recording of Stravinsky's The Flood, in which he narrates the part of Noah. Here is a presentation by Bernard Jacobson at the Stokowski Symposium at the University of Pennsylvania.
Ladies and gentlemen, I must say that looking around this room, I feel extremely nervous at the prospect of talking about Stokowski for so many people who know more about him than I do. But I'll do my best. And I think that possibly, in the circumstances, the best way for me to start is to give Stokowski the first word. Well, you're a knowledgeable lot, and it's actually the NBC Symphony Orchestra playing the second movement of the Sibelius Second Symphony under Stokowski. And excuse me, my reason for choosing that to begin with is partly personal. When I first came to this country in 1964, the first orchestral concert I ever heard in this country was in December of that year at the Academy of Music with the Philadelphia Orchestra under guest conductor Leopold Stokowski. And the program included Shaka from Smetana's Mavlast, and it included excerpts in the usual Stokowski manner, and it included the world premiere of the Koto Concerto by Henry Cowell, which some of you may remember. And you'll have to remember it if you want to think about it, because we haven't heard it very much since then. Anyway, the other work on the program was the Sibelius Second Symphony. And my conclusion at the end of this concert, here I was, a 28-year-old neophyte in the field, was, wow, this man is a genius, whether you like it or not. What was the genius about? Well, orchestral musicians have a way of talking about a conductor whom they approve of, if such exist, and by saying, well, he really has hands. Of nobody was it truer to say that than Stokowski. The hands were the first thing that struck one in the audience watching. And it was that particular passage at the beginning of the slow movement of the Sibelius that demonstrated to me the power of those hands, because he stood there. Actually, it was just one hand. Because he stood there with his left hand firmly out of the way, not to confuse matters, at his side. And with his hand, he gave you both those rhythms. The triplets, first of all, the pizzicato triplets in the strings, and then the duplet rhythms in the bassoons when they came in. And you watched this hand, and you saw both rhythms, and you realized that nothing could possibly go wrong. And I want to emphasize that this is not a purely physical thing. It's not like the pronouncements of somebody like Pierre Boulez, who goes into a lot of detail about how you can conduct five against seven and all this sort of thing, which you can see. You can watch one hand and see five and watch the other hand and see seven. That's purely physical, purely mechanical, I think. With Stokowski, this element was, even at this physical level of a hand, it was about mystery and about magic. Certain that the mystery of Stokowski sometimes tipped over into mystification. If any of you are familiar with the massive book that Oliver Daniel wrote about Stokowski, he has a wonderful chapter called The Gradual Enslavement, which is about how Stokowski, with his impeccable English accent, decided at a certain point in his career that he was going to be a Slav, and the accent gradually became thicker and the articles were dropped, and that was the way he talked, apparently, later in his life. I don't remember terribly vividly from my one meeting with him, but more of that later. But more often, the mystery I found was the real thing, and I came away from that concert completely converted. Now, I said a genius whether you liked it or not. That's a funny way to put it. Why should one not have liked it? Okay, well, I grew up in England. And I grew up as an English snob, an English musical snob at any rate. I was not in a social position to be a regular English snob, but an English musical snob. And therefore, I knew that Stokowski was just a confectioner who made wonderful, colorful bonbons of sound, but had nothing to do with the reality and the substance. Why was I wrong? But you must forgive me, because English musical life, where I had grown up, was dominated in those days by people like, and the supreme example was Otto Klemperer, who were supposed to represent something called fidelity to the letter of the score. It was years later that I discovered Furtwängler and people like that, and realized that there was more than one way to skin a cat. An example of the English attitude to Stokowski occurs in a London review, actually in that same year, 1964, of that same work, the Sibelius Second Symphony. Comparing it with other works on the program that he conducted in London on that occasion, which included, incidentally, the El Amor Brujo suite by Falla, which one of the members of our panel actually recorded with Stokowski. Howard Scott was the producer for his recording of El Amor Brujo. Comparing the Sibelius, the critic of the London Times observed that Stokowski in this work was, I quote, rather less closely attuned to the composer's own northerly latitude. Not only the tone colors sounded saturated, but changes of tempo always came a bit too soon and were a bit overdone, so that the music emerged Mediterranean blue rather than Arctic gray. I always love those generalizations. Quite interesting for a symphony that was actually begun in Rapallo. But you don't expect my critical colleagues or me to know anything about the actual facts, of course. It's interesting, that comment, by the way, about changes of tempo coming a bit too soon and being a bit overdone. It reminds me of a remark that Alfred Brendel wrote in a piece that he wrote about Furtwängler. It's never actually been published, I think, but he observed that once you had heard Furtwängler conducting the great classical masterpieces, everybody else's transitions sounded too abrupt. It's a wonderful sort of backwards way of putting it, but I think it applies also to Stokowski. He prepared things. Anyway, I've said these things about English musical life, but it wasn't, of course, just in England. In the United States, much of the musical scene was dominated by figures like Toscanini, Sell, and Reiner, who were all seen, and I say seen because, of course, these things are very imponderable, and there are many exceptions to every generalization of this kind, but who were seen as sort of following in the Weingartner-Busch tradition and thus opposing the tradition represented by Stokowski on the other side and by people like Furtwängler and Mengelberg. This is so approximate because, as anybody will know who's ever heard Weingartner's recording of the Beethoven First Symphony, with all his fidelity, he couldn't hold a tempo. terrible thing to say, but unbelievably unstable. Anyway, we don't have time for subtleties today, so I pass that by. But certainly there was a sort of freedom side and a strictness side in the public mind about music performance. And it's this notion of faithfulness to the letter of the score, along with the supposed suppression of the interpretative personality, that I regard as materialistic. And that's why I've titled my opening remarks, Magician in a Materialistic World. On one particularly revealing occasion, when an orchestral player argued that a phrasing he wanted was not printed like that in the score, Stokowski came up with a wonderful reply. He said, I've been married several times, and I have learned that there is much to be performed in a marriage which is not printed in the license. If you think about Stokowski's music making, you realize that sometimes indeed it seemed to be vice versa, and there were things printed in the license or in the score that were not to be performed. And that reminds me of a wonderful statement in Leinsdorf's book, Erich Leinsdorf's book, The Composer's Advocate, where he describes a performance of the Beethoven Seventh Symphony conducted by Stokowski, where he says that in the third movement, he describes Stokowski who skipped after making no repeats from bar 236 to bar 497, omitting one scherzo and one trio, and thus saving his Philadelphia orchestra perhaps 2.5 to 3 minutes' work, and his subscribers the annoyance of having to put up with the compulsive strain in Beethoven's character. Now, in such matters, and matters that many of us are familiar with, like his dismemberment of the first movement of the Beethoven Pastoral Symphony in the film Fantasia, which omits actually the development and recapitulation, a small issue in a sonata form movement, but there you are, Stokowski could be pretty outrageous, though often he was not as outrageous as our own wonderful English Thomas Beecham. But questions of judgment of this kind are never simple, as you realize when you think about Leinsdorf just a few years later conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra in the supposed first performance by that orchestra of the Dvorak Third Symphony, which wasn't any such thing because he left out 300 measures in the last movement. And actually even conducting a work like the Tenth Symphony, an acknowledged masterpiece of a contemporary composer, or almost contemporary at the time, Shostakovich, and making cuts in that. So nobody is consistent in these matters. But it's interesting that it was never that simple with Stokowski. It always shifted. Ground shifted as you watched it. Excuse me. If you compare some early comments on him, you find on the one hand certainly the magical element of Stokowski the performer emphasized. In 1911, a Cleveland reviewer observed, "I wish I could think of some word besides wizard to describe his wonderful virtuosity and artistry, but that is the only thing that fitly expresses his uncanny virtuosity." Same year in New York, he was described by the press as a genius and magician. And 46 years later, José Serrabrière, conductor and composer whose music Stokowski conducted and who became an assistant to him, said, "Some magic took place during the concert, and I've realized since that no other conductor that I've seen has ever had it." That's the magical side, which occurs also in Stokowski's own characterization of the power that music has to say something that no words could ever say. He described that as magic. And I think it's of a piece with what his great colleague Furtwängler said of what the performer's job is, which he said was to seek out the sense of the numinous, of another world in music. But it's interesting that Stokowski description of magic comes in his comments on Hans Richter, the great late 19th, early 20th century conductor who was certainly no mere confectioner. It's interesting when you think about that magical side of Stokowski that this was also the man for whom Richter was the idol. He was, Stokowski said, the greatest I ever heard. And it's interesting that his much-loved principal teacher was Walford Davies, the English musician, who was certainly no confectioner. And it's interesting that many of the soloists he most liked working with were intellectual giants of the Busoni and Hoffmann variety, to say nothing of his later affinity with Glenn Gould. And this soberer, more intellectual side of Stokowski is very well attested. 1912, just a year after those other reviews, the Daily Telegraph in London observed, "He is a thoughtful musician who does not allow his feelings to master his judgment." The Birmingham Post in England the same day said, "His reading often reminded me of Richter." And the Musical Courier in this country later that year observed, "He has a commanding personality, but he puts it entirely at the service of the composer." And these are very refreshing things to be reminded of in view of what has become the popular image of Stokowski as a highly self-indulgent performer. I think it's a big mistake. Also in 1912, the critic in those days of the Philadelphia Inquirer, George Rogers, commented that in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, quote, "He perfectly apprehended and splendidly communicated, and with an extraordinary fire and force and fervor, the nobility and dignity and gravity of its varied message, and there was never a moment when the suspicion was suggested that he was seeking to do anything else than to play the music as it was written and to express the whole thought of the composer." Music as it was written. Well, that's the question. It's very hard to say what the music is as it's written. And what's evident in all this, in all these views on various sides, that there are imponderables in play. I think the clue to what Stokowski was really interested in as a performer can perhaps be found in the contempt he expressed for a mere virtuoso who plays notes, not ideas. And he also said later, "The spirit of the music is the important thing, not the mere physical notes." In 1916, a Detroit critic observed, "He is not behind his rivals in scholarship, and he is a greater poet than any of them," using the word poet in the sense in which Plato used it. And I think that if he was a poet in the Platonic sense, his idea of idea, his conception of ideas, was also Platonic. Fascinating comment in the New York Sun the same year summarized his gifts as personality, force, temperament, scholarship, and imagination. It's fascinating to find this word scholarship again and again. I warrant you that 9 out of 10 people in the musical world, if you ask them today whether Stokowski was a scholar, would tend not to say yes. But I think, again, they might be wrong. And if that list, personality, force, temperament, scholarship, and imagination, sounds almost like a characterization of Prospero in The Tempest, I think it goes to emphasize that you have to know a very great deal in order to work true magic. In this balancing act between scholarship and magic, or between notes and ideas, between the physical and the spirit, the place of sound as such brings to mind what's perhaps the central paradox of Leopold Stokowski. I think he probably did, I haven't seen evidence of it, but I think he would probably have despised the concentration of our contemporary early music people on the mere sound of music, which I think goes with a certain Silver Age attitude to what music is about, this concentration on recreating the physical entity that we believe existed in the past. If you compare it with a Golden Age attitude like Mozart's conception of the best way to play a complement to Handel, which was to take several of his works and reorchestrate them with modern instrumentation and with additional chromatic harmonies, that was the way a great composer like Mozart paid tribute to another great composer. We don't have the gumption very much to do that these days. And along with the fact that he was not interested in recreating a physical sound from the past, He was, of course, obsessed with sound. That's the paradox. And it was through his manipulation of sound, and perhaps this was abetted, we can discuss that later with the panel, by his fascination with media like recording and film. It was through this fascination and this manipulation that he worked his magic. As well as being a magician, Stokowski was an explorer. And I might say in passing, he was an explorer in many fields with eccentric views in many fields. The only time I actually met him was when I was a critic in Chicago in 1968, and I attended a recording session, which was actually produced by Howard Scott, who's sitting over there, of the Shostakovich Sixth Symphony. It was a very cold February day, and Stokowski took out his hip flask during the break and took a few swigs and informed me that, of course, American brandy is much better than French cognac. I don't, as far as I can remember, think that I got a taste to see how I felt about it, but anyway, that would have been dangerously objective. But he was an explorer, and he loved new things, and he loved finding out new things. And I think that one of the most amazing and commendable things about him was his unquenchable thirst for new music. I want to play you a little example. And in addition to three United States premieres of works by the 20th century Polish-English composer Andrzej Panufnik, Stokowski also gave the world premiere of the composer's Universal Prayer, which is a setting of Alexander Pope. And I choose this particular example for four reasons. One is it's less familiar than many other examples would now be. Number two is that since the work is not written for orchestra, but for four vocal soloists, a large chorus, three harps or any multiple of three harps, and a very large part for organ, it reminds us of the beginnings of Stokowski's career as an organist, who in his early years was making arrangements in the opposite direction to the one he became famous for. Because as an organist in England in the early 20th century, he made much of his name by playing organ transcriptions or arrangements of orchestral works. Those are two reasons. The third one is that I think this example shows that very hard-edged music was just as much within Stokowski's range as the softer, more beguiling sonorities we might think of first when his name is mentioned. And the fourth and perhaps most important reason is that there's a quality which the French critic Bernard Gavotti in Le Figaro applied to Panufnik. And I think it applies equally to the composer and to the conductor in this instance. Gavotti said that what Panufnik had was the gift of incantation, of sorcery, without which music is only artifice. The sheer breadth of Stokowski's repertoire is astonishing. And again, it's interesting to contrast him with Thomas Beecham, who often seemed happiest and most effective when he was conducting the work of minor composers. I always remember the Concerto Romantique by Benjamin Godard being a great feature of his popular concerts, the Beecham popular concerts in London, of which one critic said that the definition of popular applied here seemed to be that it was they consisted of works that were popular with Sir Thomas. Unlike Beecham, Stokowski was passionately concerned to find substantial works of new music, and he came back again and again to the really great masterpieces of the past, though admittedly there were some more meretricious things that fascinated him too. For my last example, I would like to play you something that may again seem unexpected. This is the movement entitled La Paix, Peace, from Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks. hate to stop that brutally in the middle, but we're running rather late. I have just a couple more things to say, and then we will have some interesting people to talk to. But I find in that performance an enormous amount of paradox again, because there's an abundance of enchantment and mystery in it. Of course, in a sense, it's miles away from what's fashionable now. It may even sound funny to people who are tuned in to early instrument performances. Although I'm delighted to find one conductor who's very highly regarded for his mastery of Baroque style, Sir Charles McCarris, remarking, Stokowski is not necessarily being unauthentic in using a large wind band as well as a large string band, because I genuinely believe that with the fireworks music, anything goes. And yet, with all this, and with all Stokowski's taste for the highly colored, for the exotic, and for the dramatic, in my ears, his direction of this music also accords it a gravity and a chastity, even. It seems to me far beyond the reach of the many Baroque specialists who have tackled this work. It's magic indeed, and I hope it may have surprised some of you. Thank you very much.
That was Bernard Jacobson, the program annotator and musicologist of the Philadelphia Orchestra during the Mutti years, and an active musician and scholar.